Welcome to Local Talk at KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Paul Wearson, your host for today. Today we have Brian McNamara, who's going to be our guest, and it's going to be a lot of fun here. And later on, we'll have Howard Hammond from the Slater-Huxley area. And welcome to Local Talk. Well, today I could hardly wait for this program because we have Brian McNamara on here as our guest today. It's Pastor Brian McNamara, and he is a local celebrity because, well, Brian, tell him, you went to Alaska in a Model T.
I drove 7,250 miles at 30 miles an hour.
Oh.
In a Model T, a 1926 Model T pick-em-up truck.
And you had a partner. We're calling it the pastor and the prof, because who was your partner? He's a professor.
Lee Kilmer from Ames here is a retired dairy science professor from the university here, and he and I both have Model T pickups, and we drove them to Alaska and back.
Did anyone say it was a cockamamie idea when you mentioned it?
Well, the wives... They flew to Alaska and joined us when we got to Fairbanks, and then they flew back home before we turned around and drove
home. So they took it the easy way.
Well, and so many people suggested that they were perhaps the smarter of the pair. So.
But now you had to meet the wives up in, is it Fairbanks?
Fairbanks. We drove to Fairbanks.
In other words, you had a deadline on the way
We
up.
Did. We left June 1. And the gals were set to fly in on the 25th of June, which meant we really needed to be there to pick them up at the airport. And the big driving force was that we knew that if we didn't get there in time, the girls would go shopping. And there's two things about shopping that worried us is, A, it's expensive to go shopping, and it's really expensive to go shopping in Alaska.
Yeah, everything costs more in Alaska.
Yeah.
I found that out. I had a friend who, during our college years, worked up there in a fish place, and his pay was high, but everything cost an arm and a leg, and this was back in the 60s, you know. And also, by arriving on time and achieving your deadline, you saved your marriages.
We did, yes. And, you know, absence does make the heart grow fonder.
Wasn't it wonderful to have the reunion?
It was. Now, a personal note, Paul, in the 30-some years that my wife and I have been married, the 3 weeks that we were separated are the longest 3 weeks in our marriage. So it was a tax on our marriage.
That means you must be a good match. Now, everyone needs to know what a feat this was, and I think people should know, actually, how the Model T fits into automotive history. Tell us about, this was Henry Ford's first big deal.
This was his success story. 1909 to 1927, Henry Ford produced the Model T, and that's the car, as we all know, the car of the last century, and it was the car that put America and the world on wheels.
And that was also, actually, some of the first successful mass production of
yes.
the vehicle.
Henry optimized the assembly line, and he paid his workers $5 a day to get the job done. He wanted to produce a car in such quantities that the average man could afford a car. Model T, well, the 1926 model that I drove cost less than $500 in 1926, and your average, the other cars on the road were $2,000 to $3,000 a piece.
So he had something that he could make cheaply enough to sell for that price.
Yeah.
And I remember Henry Ford saying, not that I was there at the time.
Of course not.
But I mean, Henry Ford said, I want to pay my workers enough to afford to buy the car.
That's exactly right.
So this is forward thinking, too. So for all our listeners out there, I'm going to have Brian describe how a Model T differs from what you and I understand as riding in a car. So this is a simple mechanism, but by our standards, who were used to automatic transmissions and all this, kind of complex and difficult.
It's different. and we sort of tired by the third day of comments made or questions asked by people in the campgrounds and stuff like that who don't understand the mechanics of a Model T. It doesn't have an automatic transmission. It has a planetary transmission, which is a series of drums that are attached to the engine right behind the engine. And those drums have bands that clamp down on them when they're engaged. There are two speeds to a Model T, a low and a high. And when there are three pedals on the floor of a Model T.
Three pedals instead of two.
Yes, and none of them are a gas pedal.
Now explain that.
Well, see, it's kind of like driving the old tractors. The gas is advanced by a lever on the steering column.
Okay.
But if you're looking at the floorboard of a Model T, the left pedal is sort of kind of your clutch. If you push that pedal down, you're clamping a band around the engine speed in the drum. And so pushing that pedal down gives you low speed. And low speed is from 0 to 5 miles an hour. It's the speed, it's the pedal you use to move your car to a running speed. Once you get it up to about 5 miles an hour, you sort of pop the clutch. You come off of that. And then you're in high. You have two speeds, low and high.
So once you get to high, then the other two pedals, are they involved?
The middle pedal is reverse, and the vehicle must be at a complete stop before you engage reverse. And the right pedal that we would think would be the gas pedal, yeah, is actually a brake, and that's a transmission brake, and that slows the engine down. It's a little bit like the Jake brake on a semi, but not quite. But it clamps and holds the engine from going full speed.
Can it stop on a dime, or does it stop slowly?
Yeah. The Model T doesn't stop well at all. The only concession to modernity that Lee and I allowed is that we did put modern disc brakes on the rear axles.
So that really was actually a safety feature.
Everybody
also
knows, yeah, old cars don't go fast, but they don't know they don't stop fast either. So,
well, now, on June 1st, then, you headed out, and here's the caravan. You had your car, and then his car, and was he towing a camper also?
We stumbled across a 1926 Zegelmeyer pop-up camper.
Where did you find this old camper?
Well, that's a long, complicated story, but it's a factory-made camper. When Henry put the world on wheels, the world decided they wanted to go someplace. And this is before Motel 6 and Holiday Inn.
Everyone camped.
Yeah, and they wanted some amenities. And so this is a pop-up camper that if you Google Zegelmeyer Auto Camp Incorporated, you'll have all of their line drawings, because, of course, this was before they had photographs sales brochures and stuff. But you'll see this pop-up camper, and it was designed to sleep for adults.
Really?
However, I posit that back in 1926, those four adults were shorter and skinnier than they than they are today, because Lee and I took care of we were comfortably situated, the two of us. I'd hate to throw four.
And then this has sort of a canvas top that expands.
It had a wooden top and a wooden bottom, and everything else was a metal framework with canvas.
But you were comfortable in there, and hopefully it was waterproof.
No. We discovered outside of Lloydminster, when we got to Lloydminster, which is on the border between Saskatchewan and Alberta, that night, they had 8 inches of rain, and 5 inches came in the first hour. Oh. It was then that we discovered that we had sort of suspected that the canvas wasn't original.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that pretty well convinced us, because it took us 3 days to dry out.
Is that right? That's quite a rainfall.
And then they had hail on top of that.
Oh, real?
Yeah.
Oh, hail on top. Well, now, you started out on June 1st, and what we're talking about 35 miles an hour. So, what was your expectation in miles per day?
Well, we planned the trip based on the notion that we would go 25 miles an hour and that we would travel 150 to 170-ish miles, depending on where we could find campsites. And we had reservations at 23 RV campgrounds between Ames and Fairbanks. And we actually got to Fairbanks a day ahead of time. So we did better than 25. And we figure roughly that we averaged 30 miles an hour for the trip.
And so now you're in this Model T. It has a windscreen, as they say in England.
Yes. You know,
but it does, is there side windows that roll up also?
We have detachable storm curtains that we can take off in nice weather. And basically from the moment that we hit Canada, we put the storm curtains on, and they were on all the way through Canada and into We didn't go 48 hours driving up that we didn't have rain.
So you had sort of, you'd have to say it was kind of a rainy period then.
It was cold and wet going up, and it was hot and dry coming back.
Now that's really a contrast. So here you are. First of all, you could never be on an interstate highway.
No, we had to travel state and county roads. When we got to Canada, Canada has good two-lane highways with paved shoulders. Good meaning they're paved, so we could navigate those state roads easily. They don't have an interstate, apparently.
Now, the Elkan Highway, were you on the Elkan Highway?
Yeah, that's an overstated sort of expression of engineering. This is the 75th anniversary year for the Elkan Highway.
You know why I know that? Because I was born the same year as the Elkan Highway.
Ah.
They did work on that in 1943, and that was my birth year. And the Army built that as a part of the war effort.
Yes, and they also have that expression about 200 miles of bad road, and you're kind of starting to look that way,
yeah,
Paul.
Yeah, I'm looking like 200 miles of bad road.
The Elkan Highway is paved all the way.
Now, for a long time, I think it was crushed rock.
Yes, it's paved all the way to Delta Junction, except for the places where they're working on it. And in the North Country, they have two seasons. They have winter, and they have road construction.
So you encountered all this road construction?
More of it coming back, because really the summer season doesn't start till the middle of June, and we left the 1st of June. So we missed a lot of it going up, but we made up for it coming back.
Well, you know, if you're just tuning in, we have Brian McNamara here, Pastor Brian McNamara, who's describing his fabulous trip to Alaska in a Model T. Was it 1926?
1926.
1926 Model T.
91-year-old vehicle.
91-year-old vehicle. You know, my parents were married in 1927, so this goes way back. The late 20s are their time. And my gosh, you know, when you look at this Model T, and both of these vehicles had to function all the way up there. If one person breaks down, that impacts the life of the other. So what kind of breakdowns did you have? Other than metal.
And there was some of that. Outside of Lloydminster, before the rain came, my faceplate on my amp meter fell off. Now, the Model T has wooden floorboards, and I was concerned that that round piece of glass might fall through and I would lose it forever. So I reached down and grabbed it and threw it on the front seat, not realizing that the back part of that amp meter is hot-wired to the battery. So it's flopping around behind my dash as I'm driving down the road, and all the next thing I know, I have blue smoke coming out of the dash, and blue smoke coming out from the dash is not a good sign.
It's bad for a pilot, bad for a driver.
and what I ended up doing by ignoring that so long is I melted my wiring harness. Now, you can't go to a NAPA store or to a Ford dealer and secure a 1926 Model T wiring harness.
That's true.
We made an emergency roadside fix where we cut out the unnecessary melted wires, and we had some 14-gauge wires, so we were able to rewire things and get back on the road. So that was my big And big mechanical.
Well, your
failure.
Fellow traveler, Lee, did he have some breakdown?
Well, you know, I picked up his muffler twice. Lee had an aftermarket Stromberg carburetor on his car, and one of the disadvantages to that carburetor is that it can't be adjusted when you are driving the car. You have to get out, lift the hood, make the adjustment, get back in, drive it, and if it's not right, get out and do it again. Well, his car was backfiring, and as a consequence of that, he blew his muffler off twice.
But from backfires, it must have sounded like a bank shootout or something.
Yeah, it's pretty loud. And so I stopped and picked up the pieces the first time, and we were able to wire it back together, baling wire and bubble gum, you know. And then the second time, we couldn't find all the pieces. So for about 3 days, he was really loud until we could get a new muffler drop shipped to the next or to a campground down the road. So we had that problem. His generator quit the second week out, and so he had to hand crank start his car every morning. And then during the last week of that, the bolt that holds his fan pulley to the engine block broke. Now, I've had Model Ts for 25 years, and I've never touched that bolt, and his happened to break. So he drove without a generator or an alternator and without a fan for a good portion of the trip going up. Now, you try that with a modern car. If your generator quits or your fan doesn't work, you can't get out of the driveway.
No, exactly. But that car functioned through all that.
As long as the car's moving, it cools, and with the hand crank, you can start a Model T.
Well, you know, this you had to have a lot of interesting interactions with people along the way. When people spot you, there's a double take, right?
Oh,
it's two Model
or
Ts.
Or triple. when we got to Fairbanks, and the folks at the campground there are old car people that own the campground, and so they had sort of let other folks know there that we were showing up, but we showed up a day early. We pulled in there, and we hadn't even shut the cars off, and there were 20 people standing around wanting to know all there was to know.
And they had all kinds of questions.
Oh, now, at one point, Lee and I really regretted that we didn't make a placard that we could set up and say, come back at 7, all your questions will be answered. Because
yeah.
Pull into a campground and there's a parade of people coming by and they're all asking the same questions.
Oh, sure. I bet children were fascinated by this.
We introduced some young people into the marvels of the Model T. At one campground, there was a high school gal that was just keenly interested, and Lee ended up taking her for a ride.
Really?
And allowing her to drive. And,
what?
Boy, she had the biggest smile on her face when that one was
Isn't
done.
Isn't that funny? Who gets tickled by that?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Who gets – I'm sure a lot of smaller children were utterly fascinated
yeah.
because their parents probably had to explain what this was.
Well, kids know that it's different
yeah.
and it's old. And many of them, I put two young people, 4 and 5 years old, something like that, in the front seat, and they were just all smiles sitting there.
Yeah, right. You know? It's just such a marvelous different
yeah.
experience.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, given the human race and its condition, that you encountered wonderful people. Now, were there people – did people misbehave on the road? You said something about logging trucks.
Yes. We put the slow-moving vehicle signs on the back of our vehicles, the orange triangle, and that really saved the day, I think, in a lot of cases for us. We never had anybody flip us off or yell at us or give us any kind of angry gesture. But there's a special group of folks that drive the logging trucks from points north and east of Fort St. John in Canada that pretty much own the road. And now these are trucks that carry 3 trailers, 20-foot lengths, and they have logs stacked in them. And so,
wait a minute, 3 trailers that are that long?
Each trailer is 20. So
it's like a train.
It is like a train. And when that whistle blows and they steam around you, you better yield the road. And sometimes They miscalculate the judge, the distance.
Yeah.
I have a distinct memory of a logging truck coming around me, and what I realized it was there is when the rear tandem axles began moving in my direction. And there's 5-6 feet of log sticking out behind that. And the driver was either intentional, and I don't want to believe that, but he came over in the lane that was occupied by me, and Newton a long time ago told us that two bodies can't occupy the same space.
No.
Yeah. So I've maintained there's a special place in the afterlife for logging truck drivers, and I'm pretty sure it's a warm place.
they were discourteous, to say the least.
Well, they get paid by the load.
Oh,
and
sure.
So if they can shave a minute or two here and a mile or two there, they're all about that.
So you were an obstacle to their actual sustenance of life. You were in the way.
We were glad when we passed the pulp mill in Fort St. John and knew that the traffic was going to be kinder and gentler.
Well, now, what was the actual low point of the trip when you almost said, wish we didn't come this far?
Well, really, Lloydminster. I mean, that was the point where Lee's generator quit, and I fried my wiring harness. When we got up that next morning after the 8 inches of rain, we were cold and we were wet, and it was just miserable. And really, if somebody had given me a bus ticket, I'd have left the car parked in the campground.
Goodbye, Model T. it's fascinating. How was this idea born? You've been planning this for quite a while, probably.
Well, I've owned Model Ts for over 25 years. In 2001, there were a group of Model Ters down in Texas, and they had a monthly meeting, and they're sitting around at the Dairy Queen after their monthly meeting, and somebody says, well, what should we do next? And somebody said, we ought to drive to Alaska. And so 2 weeks later, they met at a Walmart parking lot and headed north to Alaska. And they had a blog, and it was written up in one of the national magazines for Model Ters, and I read that, and I thought, you know, why not?
Why not do that?
And so then, I said something to Lee at some point, and Lee very wisely said, well, if we're going to do that, we should both have the same kind of vehicle, and they ought to be pickups. Now, at that point, I think he was putting me off because he had a pickup and I didn't. So that was 10, 15 years ago. And 5 years ago, I got my pickup. Now, it had to be restored. So as we got closer to the end of that project, we got more serious, and last year was pretty much dedicated to making sure that our vehicles were mechanically equipped and ready for the trip.
So as both people had to have a pickup simply for cargo and tools and all that?
Well, yeah, we wanted to carry enough parts that we could fix whatever broke. What we discovered is that everything that broke was not something we anticipated would break.
Is that right?
Yeah. So nothing – well, Lee broke a fan belt, and we did have three of those.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the idea was with the same model year and the same type of car, we could take interchangeable parts, and we needed the space to carry those parts.
Oh.
But we didn't bring a generator. And we didn't bring an extra wiring loom, and
it's
we didn't
what
have
you
a
didn't
muffler.
Expect that
yeah,
happened.
Yeah.
Oh my! Now, here's some history, everybody out there. Brian, explain how the term pickup originated.
You know, this is a good trivia.
You can win your trivia
game.
Contest.
Yeah. In 1925. Or 1924, Henry Ford looked around and realized that people were taking the rear turtle deck of the roadsters and the coupes off and building wooden bodies, boxes, to make what we today call a pickup. And he thought to himself, there's money to be had here. So in 1925, he offered a steel box that people could order. And
from the factory.
From the factory. But it came to the dealer. So you had to order it from the dealer, and then you had to go to the from the factory, and then you had to go to the dealer and pick it up. And that is where we get the phrase for every modern-day pickup truck.
That's it, folks. Aren't you glad you got up and heard this? Because basically, I never knew that, ladies and gentlemen. I did not know where the term pickup came from.
Yeah.
So that's where it comes from. When Henry Ford actually designed and responded to what the community was telling him, because they were making their own pickup trucks.
And then in 26 and 27, he had a factory-produced pickup truck, which is what Lee and I both drive.
So he was not only a pioneer in creating mass production and all of that sort of thing and the mechanics of building a car, he was also an excellent marketer, wasn't he?
He was.
He responded to what the people were wanting, needing, and building themselves if it wasn't available commercially.
When Henry Ford produced the Model T, he expected people would drive them 5,000 miles and then trash them and buy a new one. Now, Lee and I just put 7,250-ish miles on our Model Ts, and we figure we probably drove those cars further in the last 2 months than in all their previous existence.
Is that right? That's remarkable. Now, what's the expected lifetime of these vehicles now that you've just pushed them to their limits?
Well, mine's sitting in the garage, and it will be quite comfortably ensconced there for some time. I have no desire.
You don't want to see the inside of that car for
well,
some time.
My lower rear quadrant left a distinct impression in the car seat, and the car seat left an impression on my lower rear quadrant, and we're not going there for a while.
Well, that's like NASA with the form-fitting couches for astronauts.
Yeah. We have been there. And we have done that, and we don't intend to repeat this or do anything like this again. We have bragging rights, and we're content with that. We both had our cars thoroughly rebuilt before the trip, and so we should get another. We should get another 5,000 miles on our rebuilt engines, and that will last, as far as I'm concerned, the rest of my life.
Now, when you rebuild one of those engines, you're talking about new pistons?
We take the head off, they put new pistons, or they bore them out, and they pour new Babbitt, and, they're completely mechanically rebuilt.
What about parts and things like that? Isn't it very difficult to find parts for something that?
Well, I was in Lloydminster, Canada, and in Edmonton, Canada, which in a modern car is just 2 hours down the road. There is a Model A and a Model T parts distributor.
There is.
Yeah. And in Iowa, in Colfax, there's a Model T parts distributor. There are a series of vendors that sell either reproduced or new old stock Model T parts.
Well, that's a revelation to me because this is a car that's, like you said, the production is 90 years ago, and yet there must be enough hobbyists and people who are involved with Model Ts that people can set up a business providing parts.
They figure, Ford made 15 million Model Ts, and they figure there's 100,000 out there yet today.
So 100,000 Model Ts are out there?
Yeah.
Wow.
As a retired United Methodist pastor, in almost every church that I served, when people found out that I had a Model T, they told me to go see old so-and-so who's farms out west of town or whatever, and I'd go out there and, I got a Model T, and it's sitting back in one of the sheds.
Is that
now,
right?
I can't buy it, and I can't, we won't drive it, but it's there.
What
so
a revelation to me.
Yeah.
I just did not know that because, unless you are really in tune with this and involved with it, you just wouldn't know these things.
When I moved to Story City, I brought a 1923 Model T Touring. And that was the third Model T, 1923 Model T Touring in town.
Is that right?
Yeah. There are two 1923 Model T Tourings in Story City.
Yeah, I can think of one besides. Now, how many have you owned, actually, Brian, by this time?
Model T. You see, I'm a purist. I buy a car, and I fix it up and drive it, and then I sell it. And I'm on my fifth Model T.
Fifth car. Wow.
Yeah. Now, some people whose name would remain anonymous, buy one Model T, fix it up and drive it, and then they buy another one and fix it up and drive it, and then they end up with five Model
Ts. Sounds like Lee.
I didn't say that.
Aren't you glad I said that instead? Oh, by the way, it's station break time. It's KHOI 89.1 FM. This is the Story City, Ames, and surrounding area radio station. We've been talking with Brian McNamara, and he's been telling us about his fabulous adventure driving from central Iowa all the way to Fairbanks, Alaska, with his friend Lee in Model Ts. These are cars that are over 90 years old, and Brian and his partner fixed them up. But it's still an adventure to go, what, 30 miles an hour, Brian?
For yeah, that 7,250
miles.
I went up the mountains at 5 miles an hour.
Well, now, how does a Model T perform in, you know, uneven ground like that?
It doesn't.
It doesn't perform.
You wake up knowing it's going to be a long day when you have mountains to climb. But my Model T went over 4 mountain passes coming and 4 mountain passes going.
So it did it. And so did Lee's.
Yes.
You both got through. Because, you know, it's you talk about relatively flat and negotiable terrain, then you're fine. But, you know, anything like a mountain in modern-day cars, Pikes Peak or some of the driving in Colorado is challenging. So I just thought that has to be tough for a car from that vintage. Well, we've been – Brian, I hate to cut this short because actually it's been fun to talk to you and – this is Pastor Brian McNamara, retired, and he's talked to us today about his fabulous adventure driving a Model T from central Iowa to Fairbanks, Alaska on the Elkan Highway and other assorted roads. What a great adventure, and in honor of you, Brian, we're going to play the old Johnny Horton hit, North to Alaska.
To Alaska, go north, the rush is on. North to Alaska, go north, the rush is on. Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92. With George Pratt, his partner, and brother Billy, too. They crossed the Yukon River and found the Bonanza Gold. Below that old white mountain, just a little southeast of Nome, Sam crossed the majestic mountains to the valleys far below. He talked to his team of huskies as he mushed on through the snow. With the northern lights a-running wild in the land of the midnight sun. Yes, Sam McCord was a mighty man in the year of 1901. Where the river is winding, big nuggets they're finding. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. Way up north, way up north. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. George turned to Sam with his gold in his hand. Said, Sam, you're looking at a lonely, lonely man. I'd trade all the gold that's buried in this land for one small band of gold to place on sweet little Jimmy's hand. 'Cause a man needs a woman to love him all the time. Remember, Sam, a true love is so hard to find. I'd build for my Jenny a honeymoon home below that old white mountain, just a little southeast of Nome, where the river is winding, big nuggets they're finding. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. North to Alaska, I go north, the rush is on. Way up north, way up north.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, that was Johnny Horton, his old hit, North to Alaska, as a, well, it's a transitional thing for us to get out through the interview with Brian McNamara about his trip to Alaska. in a Model T Ford. And Johnny Horton is, of course, no longer with us. He was killed by a drunk driver. That's how his life ended. And he had several hits back in the late 50s and early 60s. That was North to Alaska. Now we're transitioning to a different part of the territory. We have our friend and actually reporter for KHOI, Howard Hammond here. Hi, Howard. How are you?
Good morning. Pleased to see you here.
And Howard is going to update us on everything that's happening in Slater-Huxley area. First of all, Howard, tell me about the 4th of July. How did that go in Slater?
Well, as you know, Paul, because you've been a party in our territory, it goes pretty well, and this year was no exception. That activity that people start preparing for actually in November of the November month prior to that 4th of July celebration, which this year came on a Tuesday. So we started celebration almost on Sunday night and kept pretty busy through Monday and Tuesday.
How many people do you figure visited? Over 10,000, I think, sometimes.
I'm really glad you asked that question. I'll tell you how thorough our outfit and the volunteers are. Our city administrator advised me as recent as light before last that there's a lot of guesswork goes on. At one time, it was told in 1989 when we had our centennial, there were 10,000 people, but nobody ever took account. So she was on the ball this year, and she actually had some 4-H'ers take counters and do the best they could to walk through the entire day and actually through the parade, which is about 10 o'clock in the morning of Tuesday the 4th. And sure, her report is right at 7,600 people.
Really? Good. That's great. Yep. And I think that we had a guest on our show here a while back. It was someone from the Historical Society. They had some new exhibits, I think, in the History Museum there.
You got it, right. Turns out that there was an abundance of effort put into being ready by the 4th of July time as best we could for the people. Well, actually, I'll back up to say usually that 4th of July celebration, Slater's somewhat of a homecoming. And so people almost, I'd say half the states of the nation, if I could stretch it a little, showed up at that museum. We call it Heritage Hall that we started in the year 2002. And now the beauty of it is they just at the few days before the 4th managed to open a brand new addition, new building, which doubled the size of our museum. So that was an attraction to the city those days before and after the 4th.
And so that was probably a great thing for those who were returning as a homecoming.
Precisely.
Yeah. But I think the main thing here is just the fact that you had a great turnout and everyone was happy with the outcome. A lot of great food, I'm sure, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's some new introductions to that. Not only do some of the local folks, such as, the people close to in Story County persons as vendors, but now, as many of people know, there's the popular food trucks. And so there was, lots of edibles as well as inflatables. How about that? Inflatables and edibles. How do you like that?
That's pretty difficult diction for someone our age.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah.
So it was a lot of fun times at Slater.
Yeah, you bet.
And what's new down there? What's going on in Slater that's worthy of mention right now to keep us updated on Southern Story County?
Well, you walked right into my trap. I had that mental image coming at you. Turns out that, let me back up a little, Paul, and we're taking a lot of credit here for Slater, but, you know, across our county, seems like every community brings some leadership local, plus the volunteers coming forward, and you could name them off, Collins Day, Scandinavian Story City, Gilbert Days, so on and so forth. So those homecomings are a great thing for each community and a great thing for our county. Well, it's another activity is about to happen come first part of September. A meeting was held in Slater last night to put together another big activity. You might say a mini 4th of July for Slater again. And it'll also happen in Boone and I believe I understand Ames. What's happening is the television station, Channel 13, 1040, has what they call an RV TV. And so their unit will be in Slater on Tuesday, September 5th. And they will be there from, my understanding is, almost noon on through to 10 o'clock at night as they broadcast.
And this will be the radio station,
WHO, right. Okay. And so they already started planning for a parade of a kiddie parade again, which is standard for 4th of July. Mm-hmm. And they've started planning for a golf car parade, as well as more vendors, et cetera. So it probably will be a stretch. I shouldn't put it down, but it'll be a stretch to get to 7,000 people like we did for the 4th.
But it's going to be a mini 4th of July celebration for Slater.
Somewhat.
And yep. WHO will be involved, and it'll get some publicity beyond the borders of Slater, actually.
Correct. Matter of fact, as I say, I'm sure I'm right. Boone was mentioned in a little question, I think, Ames.
And so WHO will be going to those towns also for some similar celebration.
Correct. Okay. And so here again, it's whipping local folks into action to come together and brag on their communities, but also make entertainment and education a thing of the current.
No, that's fabulous because, you know, it's kind of nice to have something in the fall, a fall festival type of.
Well, as a matter of fact, Slater did have a fall festival, but then I guess you got to come down to admit to facts, and that is, and I hear it so reported by other communities, it's a little harder each year to bring together those. The leaders seem to be stepping up, but some of them are tiring. Myself, having been around a sufficient number of decades, I realized that the number of people showing out to be on the planning groups is fewer and fewer. There's more and more activities of sports, more activities, well, I'll just leave it there, in the communities. And the work settings, societal developments has fixed it. So it's pretty hard to maintain some of your memberships. The local group that really sponsors our 4th of July and this upcoming RVTV thing is our community club, supported, of course, by other organizations in the city. But you have to work to get the volunteers out. We're finding it so, even though we're very anxious now with our new addition to our museum, but it's helpful to get the word spread and bring folks forward to help.
Yeah, to do two major events in 1 year, I would say the same as true in my town of Story City. You know, you've got limited time, and so the people who are already volunteering do so, sometimes at great sacrifice to, you know, the time available that they have away from work and raising children and all this sort of thing. So I'm really appreciative that it gets done every year. And so if you do a second major thing, that can be a real challenge to staff that.
That's true. And, it's just a matter of appealing to people that for the benefit to be derived by the total population and those that come in. And then because I've been an educator all my life, I think we need to try to keep those activities going along with the 4-H's, the FFAs, the other organizational activities for youth, because after all, they're the generations they're going to replace. And it's a matter of educating that group as to how we elders put things together and manage the leadership of the communities for the benefit of all.
Well, yeah, we just came off the Story County Fair. And what we're doing here is revisiting that in my world because I had baby beef cattle. I was in 4-H. Every year I sold the cow, and my bank account went up, and my college fund increased. So those calves gave their life for my BA degree.
Well, at least you had that didn't happen by accident. That was severe planning.
That's right. And I tell you what, there are winners and losers in that thing. But I went over to the fairgrounds, and to me it looks just as wholesome, vibrant, busy, and involved as it did when I was actually in 4-H back in the 50s. And I admit it was the 50s. By the way, everybody out there, we're talking with Howard Hammond, who is from Slater in the Huxley area. He's updating us on things going on in Southern Story County. Now, Howard, the school system for you folks is Ballard
Correct.
High School.
Correct.
Now,
yep.
What communities does that encompass?
That came together, Paul, in 1958. And the first graduating class was of that 58-59 year. That brought I should be careful here. Maybe I should say this alphabetically so I don't keep talking Slater.
Be very careful, alphabetically.
So Slater will be the last name. Yeah, Cambridge, and if I have this right, Kelly and Huxley and Slater, okay. 1958. And that followed about the same time the North Fork School District came together. That was just south of us. They also had four communities as they now exist in North Polk. And they have been the same since then. No, to my knowledge, no border changes. And if I was a real astute at our history, I could tell you how many acres that is, but the enrollments and so forth. Our Slater community has, into that school district, approximately 1,500 people now. And Huxley is, I think, right at, somebody can do some checking on the consensus. I think it's 3,200, 3,400 in that area, growing. Probably the fastest growing city in our area. It's great that that's central because it is the junior high or middle school.
Middle school is in Huxley.
Gotcha. Middle school Huxley and the new, I think, 4-year-old high school now that in Huxley. So that gives us our elementary centers in Cambridge and Slater.
Now, that is a state-of-the-art high school, Ballard. It's
correct.
Only how long? 4 years?
About 4 years running now, yeah.
Yeah, I've been in there. It's a fabulous facility. Yeah. And I would say that's a 3A school, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess it's 3A.
Yeah, depends. Yeah, right.
Like North Polk is 2A, Roland Story is 2A.
I think you got it.
I think you folks are 3A.
I think you got it, yeah. Yeah.
Anything new at the school that you're aware of that's going
on?
Yeah,
yeah. You're I should tell your listeners, there's no script. You and I are just rambling.
That's
here.
Right. We're just...
Be careful how we ramble, maybe. Don't start singing. I'll have to harmonize with you if you do.
We're good friends. I confess that Howard's my friend.
Okay. Yeah. That's German. You know, that's the German.
I don't
know
if you're Norwegian, too.
Is it Norwegian, too? Okay. Well, it turns out that 2 years ago, it was fermented. I guess that's an okay word to use. It's fermented for 4 or 5 years that we ought to move forward as some of the other cities and districts in our area and have an educational foundation. So the Ballard, BEA, Ballard Educational Foundation, I guess it's BEF. I was on that planning committee, and we said, maybe we should call it BEEF for beef. No, that doesn't sound right. Somebody will nail us with that.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's Ballard Educational Foundation. And they've been operational now 2 years. They've had two gala celebrations, a very astute planning officers and board members. The most recent activity that I believe I'm reporting right was a gala celebration that raised on-site $60,000.
Wow.
And I believe it was at least that summer a little larger the year before. And so that money's, as you know, supports the school board. I should give accolades to those people who are serving on that board.
Well, it's very tough to found a foundation because you have to have seed money, and then you grow from there.
Precisely.
And at Roland Story, where I'm familiar with their foundation, mm-hmm. a lot of the money goes to scholarships and various things that really directly benefit the students.
Correct.
Too, you know?
Correct. And that is alongside our Dollars for Scholars program, which has been in place for over 20 years. And so that has grown to the extent that I believe on that planning board we had something like $200 scholarships given initially. In this last issuing the funds, I believe it's near $500 for something like 90 graduates that applied. And that money goes directly into the pocket of the student. All they have to do is commit to pursue post-secondary education. So,
and this can be a four-year college or more of a trade school like DMAC would offer.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I can't take any credit, but a few of us were a little concerned on how the money would be moved on the scholarship, whether it's, as you just said, just repeating for emphasis, whether it's military school, whether it's a trade school, whether it's community college, so long as it's post-secondary, because it's, as all the educators of the nation will tell you, it's post-secondary education. If you're planning, that's a direction you need to go.
Well, I think one of the great things about Iowa, and I've heard this from a lot of sources, they say our main exports are agricultural products and brains. And it's an excellent place to be educated because throughout Iowa, whether it's Roland Story or central Iowa towns mm-hmm. like Ballard and you know the Ballard Community School District mm-hmm. with Huxley, North Polk, Nevada, all of these schools have very high graduation rates. and very high percentages of people who go on to post-secondary education.
Correct, yep.
And so we're just a mill of people who are highly qualified. And, you know, when I talk to people who I know well and their children are, you know, beyond college, and I ask where they are, oh, Barbara's in Seattle and Bill's in Chicago. And so, you know, they're just moving all over the place because they've got such an education background and basically, I would say, a work ethic that comes from the Middle West, too, you know.
Precisely. Yeah. Well, the other dimension of that is whether you're talking about the Dollars for Scholars program at Ballard or whether you're talking about the Ballard Education Foundation or whether you're talking about our own what we call Slater Area Historical Association, all those all the graduates and all the people that are moving through these systems of our schools, as you say, are worldly. And now Ballard probably has about 4,200 graduates spread all over the globe. And so it's just smart to try to maintain a data bank of those people because, well, not to reach out necessarily. We first think, I better be careful how I say this, we think of where they have achieved success, where they may have a bank account that will help us back here locally, to be honest.
But you gave back to the community.
Back
you gave
community.
So much to them.
Precisely. Yeah, right. You got it. That nails it. Yeah, it isn't so much we reach for their pocket. Is that, do you want to keep things happening that you experienced in our settings of, well, we'll brag on Story County and specifically our school districts and cities?
I think it's people have a profound instinct to return not only physically to the homecomings like you're talking about at the 4th of July, but mentally there's a home too. And you have a feeling of responsibility and maybe to give back to organizations like the local school foundation where people coming behind you benefit in the same way you did.
Yeah, correct.
It's loyalty. It's knowing where you came from and all the folks who enabled you to become what you are. And that's what you're hoping for, that these folks will give back to the community and build this foundation.
Yeah, precisely. Yep. Yeah. And we're glad. Matter of fact, I slip over another little topic, if it's permissible here, that kind of fulfills what we're, I guess it adds a dynamite to what we're saying. And that is the trail system that's developing in our state. I believe I'm correct here to say that there was, when the railroads were laid in the USA, railroad rails, that Iowa had about one of the largest numbers of railway rails laid in those years of yesteryear because of hauling products and our grains and our livestock, et cetera. So now many of those, as everybody knows, they're disbanding those rails. So the trail system for multi-use trails has been developing.
And that's the old railheads.
You
railhead.
Got it. And yep.
That, you can go from Des Moines to all kinds of... Howard, we're running out of time. Do you realize we've eaten up a half hour here?
Oh, did we do that?
That's fantastic.
We'll have to get the coffee shop and finish it.
We'll do it again, Howard. Yes, we've been talking with Howard Hammond of the Slater-Huxley area. You've been listening to the Local Talk program here at KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Paul Wearson. Thank you for listening today. Earlier in the show, we did hear from Brian Bactabera on his fabulous trip to Alaska, and Howard Hammond has been updating us on activities in Slater and Huxley. Earlier, we heard Johnny Horton's old record of North to Alaska. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org, and you can find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our show today was engineered by Rebecca Reuter, and our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we will train you. So come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from Foodies and Brew. Friday, August 4th, when in downtown Ames, live music accompanies beer tasting and food from local chefs. Proceeds go to historic preservation, beautification, and economic development of downtown Ames. Friday, August 4th, 6 to 9 p.m. Food sampling will occur between 6:30 and 8:30. For more information, go to amesdowntown.org. That's amesdowntown.org.